It is August the 30th, 2019, and this is episode 12 of the official podcast of the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care. Coming up on this episode, since missing an episode last month, we catch up on 2 months' worth of urgent bites, including torus fractures. When is it a torus, and when do you splint? What is the best way to reduce a pulled elbow? Has Dave used the syringe technique for non-traumatic mandible dislocations? And we look at a strange case of sore throat, and wonder why New Zealand doesn't fund the safest drug for nausea and vomiting in pregnancy. Okay, so welcome back, Dave. We missed last month's episode, which was due to us both being overseas and lots of other things going on. So we skipped an episode. But I'm joined again by Dr. David Sorrell, the Director of Clinical Training for the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care. Hello, Dave. Welcome back.
Hello, everyone. It's good to be back.
So we've got a few things to catch up on from the last couple of months. And we'll start with the chat I had with Richard Chen, who is now a fellow of the college. And he did his literature project on nausea and vomiting in pregnancy. And a couple of interesting things came out of that talk. There was his identifying doxylamine as a very safe and useful treatment for nausea and vomiting in pregnancy, but it's not funded in New Zealand, so it ends up costing about $1 a day for the ladies who need that. And you can add in pyridoxine at the same time. And he also highlighted that there's quite a high usage in first and second line of ondansetron, which is usually at the bottom of the list of most guidelines and recommendations, or to use it in that really severe kind of hyperemesis early stages to get control over the vomiting. But there seems to be quite a high prescription use identified in the population that he surveyed. And it also highlighted the fact that the classifications have changed recently in medicines and pregnancy have gone from the old ABC to a slightly different kind of classification system. So what were your thoughts around this one? Do you have anything to add to what Richard was saying?
So it's a very interesting problem that we have in New Zealand, that the perhaps safest and first line drug is not in actual fact funded in any way, shape and form, which I guess is similar to the circumstances with melatonin, which is also a very, very useful medication, not necessarily for the same thing. So we have this problem of we would like to prescribe what we think is the best medication, and in actual fact, there's going to be a cost. And for some, that makes a difference, and for others, it doesn't. So you have to have an interesting conversation with your patients. Obviously, you can prescribe the pyridoxine. The other thing is, of course, in other circumstances, it's not able to be used. So it's not available in an oral absorbable compound like ondansetron or buccostem, and it's not available in an intravenous or intramuscular form. So it's only useful as an ongoing medication for hyperemesis, but it does seem to be the safest. And so often you're juggling this balance of I need to give an IV drug and therefore I've only got metoclopramide, Maxlon, or procalperazine, Stematil, and they have some significant side effects sometimes, but they can be given along with fluids. And then ondansetron, which is available intravenous as well as oral absorbable tablet. And I think sometimes we do a bit of a juggling act, and it would be good if our choices were wider. And then again, having a look at the pregnancy categorizations, it's quite hard to read now, and it almost reads as a relative thing, which I guess it is. Everything is relative, but quite hard to work out which is the safest and best. And it doesn't come out in a list form that you'd have to go through your list manually and check what it says, and then you still might not understand it afterwards. But I think it was a very good research project and highlighted perhaps the difference between America and the Southern Hemisphere, where it's very, very common medicine over there.
Yeah, it was a good project, and it was nice to get Richard's input into the podcast. And the next talk last month was on point of care ultrasound by Kelvin Ward. There's more to come from Kelvin going forward on the podcast, and I gather you're going to an introductory course on POCUS. So once you've done that, we'll have a chat to you, Dave, about POCUS going forwards in the future. But yeah, that was an interesting chat with Kelvin, and I enjoyed it, and it certainly opened my eyes to the possibilities of POCUS going forwards. But if we go back a couple of months now, I think almost, we had a bite where we talked with Zoe Cruz about a case of non-traumatic mandible dislocation that she'd had, that she managed to reduce using the syringe technique. And I thought that was fascinating, because previously the only ones I've seen reduced have been done with the thumbs in the mouth and hinging the mandible back into place, usually after a reasonable amount of analgesia and sedatives. And this was done without any of those, and within a couple of minutes using this technique. And it seems to be, certainly the study I found, 30 out of 31 achieved reduction using this gentle technique. So have you come across the technique, or have you used it at all?
Unfortunately, I haven't had an opportunity, and I'm really excited to try it out on the next one. The only case that we had recently had been in and out of the clinic for so long, about 8 hours, that I wasn't really tempted, and I wasn't actually the doctor treating the patient. But I gather they did try it in hospital, and it had failed on that patient. But it did seem like an extremely complicated case, this one's where x-rays didn't confirm a dislocation, but they thought that they reduced it after conscious sedation. So I think it has some great advantages, that it's easy, the equipment is simple, and you don't need any sedation, because obviously you can't really risk sedating a patient, especially when their airway is a little bit upset. And so it would be something I look forward to trying with the very next atraumatic jaw dislocation, someone who yawns too hard or eats too much, something to look forward to.
And it's perfect for urgent care because of that, those points that you mentioned, but also it's patient controlled. So if they put the syringe in and find it too uncomfortable, then you can stop. But if they're comfortable and prepared to carry on, then they're in control of it. So it's a really good first line one to try before thinking of the more, because not only the medication risk, you've also, when you put your thumbs inside the mouth, there's always a bite risk. Somebody, if they get a sudden pain or spasm, you could end up being bitten. So there's a certain amount of operator risk involved. And yeah, that was a really nice case, and I'm grateful to Zoe for highlighting that to me, and any registrars listening that I have an interesting case that they would like to present in the same way that Zoe did, I would encourage them to get in contact, please. And we'll jump forward to the torus fracture. Now, while I was in the UK, I was able to access the NICE guidelines, because they're locked to UK IP addresses, and I was having a read of the one on fracture management, and the torus fracture, according to NICE, they recommend splinting and no follow-up and no ongoing x-rays or anything like that. And so did a little bite just asking for people's opinions on this, and why in some cases we actually manage in a plaster cast. And we had an email from Stephen Stelz, which I will just read a little bit from. He highlights that there's been in a variety of literature that indicates that torus fractures can be managed in a plaster, without a plaster, sorry. But he's found that selecting patients is important. And he says, I'll manage in a splint in select select patients, but have found that most patients tend to be too uncomfortable in these. And I think that's probably one of the main reasons to consider splinting or casting is the pain at the time, but also the parental concern that the child might be knocked around at school or get pushed around or fall on it or do more damage if they fall on it. He also agreed that they don't necessarily require repeat x-rays, and obviously repeat x-rays come with their own increased radiological risk. He also said at 1 week that would reassess to make sure that they're comfortable and moving okay. So there is a little bit of follow up that he would do with these people. So, what are your thoughts on torus fractures and the management of them?
So my opinion is based on the classification of the fracture, and it's important to note that any angulation probably does not represent a torus fracture. And you see a variety of interpretations, such as angulated buccal fracture. My feeling is that if it is angulated, then it is a green stick fracture, and it may be a single cortex green stick fracture with a buccal deformity. But if it's angulated, it can continue to angulate. And so I have seen a number of what have been called buccal fractures increase in their angulation. We know that at various ages, the body can remodel quite well. So at 6 years of age or up to 8 years of age, you can remodel at 10 degrees per year. So if you've got a 30 degrees angle fracture, it will remodel sometimes straight. However, if you've got a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old or older than that, it will not remodel. And so it's important to remember the difference between a undisplaced torus fracture and an angulated green stick fracture. And I think it's better to call anything that's tilted or angulated a green stick fracture. And those ones should be watched to see whether the angulation is going to increase, because they certainly can. And it's quite difficult to tell on the first x-ray. So yes, I tend to manage in splints. Personally, I use the Exos splint for my forearm fractures. And I have a protocol that I use in my clinic for the angulated green stick fractures and the torus fractures. But also they can wear it for protection afterwards, because there's this phenomenon where the green stick fractures can refracture quite dramatically. And so they usually require some protection afterwards, unlike the true torus fracture. And I don't think it's defined very well in these studies, the difference between those two. And that's what concerns me, that I see a number of patients that I'm following up that they've called just a buccal or torus fracture, and there's 10 to 15 degrees of angulation, which, you know, it's not very pleasant to have to explain to a parent at 6 weeks why their children's wrist is crooked, and explaining how long it will take to remodel and the follow-up for that.
So you would look at the angle as the defining difference between a true buccal fracture, which should be just a little cortical buckle or a little cortical it's a little bump, isn't it? Really, it's meant to look like the base of the those columns, those old Greek columns, where the that they're known as toruses, which is why they get called a torus fracture, because there's little protrusions at the bottom of a column. If you see an angulation, even if there is associated buckling, you would go one step further and call it a green stick. That happens.
I think it's the safest. It's really hard to tell the difference between a unicortical green stick fracture and a bicortical green stick fracture. And the bicortical green stick fractures are the ones that definitely can angulate and should be watched with weekly x-rays. So personally, I define them as a angulated or non-angulated. And that's what I, and if there's absolutely no angulation, you know, if you cover up the buccal deformity and look at the other cortex, is it curved, is it bent? And that's how I manage them, whether they're volar angulated or dorsal angulated, because that's the important thing, the angulation.
So it doesn't have to have a visible breach of the cortex on the X-ray, in your opinion?
In my opinion, it's the study that might be flawed. And so, therefore, do we actually trust the X-ray? Is it telling you the entire truth? I think that perhaps it's limited in what it can tell you, and that we may not be interpreting it correctly.
Because certainly there's a number of guidelines out there that would reference treating a buccal fracture in a splint and then no follow-up. And so in a true buccal fracture with that you're happy is not a green stick fracture, are you following those ones up at all, or only at the patient's discretion?
So personally, I am following them up, but I am using a splint, and then we decide how long it's going to be immobilized for, usually until it's not sore over the fracture site. So I kind of manage my Salter Harris ones and my true torus fractures the same way, that they may be in a splint that's removable and waterproof for about 3 weeks, and then you compress the fracture site manually. So you push and see if it's sore, and can they rotate? And if they can rotate without discomfort and it's not sort of push on, then they can come out, but they'll probably wear the splint for sport.
And for you're not re-x-raying those, as Stephen said in his
Well, this is the controversial thing. Is the first x-ray correct? So it depends where the fracture is. The further down it is in the shaft, the more likely I am to get another image. And I just had a patient with bilateral fractures. So his left one was a true torus fracture and his right one was a green stick fracture. And the angulation, fortunately, only increased to about 9, 10 degrees, which doesn't require any other manipulation. And so I did follow that one up with x-rays, and now I'm just reviewing it at 5 weeks. If it gets more than 15 degrees, then I would consider an orthopedic review. I think probably at 15 degrees, they still wouldn't reduce it. But this person is 11 years old, and so their remodeling capacity is reduced.
And Stephen also mentioned that parental interest in plastering is to keep them from hurting their arm again. Do you think that plaster versus splint, or the exosplint in your cases, is actually better at prevention of, because it comes with its own problems of it's not removable, they can get wet and dirty and, showering, etc.
So in my clinic, often we put them in a back slab until they can get to the hand therapist, because the hand therapists fit the exos, which is a thermoplastic. So it's cooked in an oven to mold to the child's wrist. And then it has a latch that's tightened and reduced so that it can open that up. So we tend to use, what I tend to do is if it's a green stick fracture, I put them in a back slab and they try to see their hand therapist the next day, and then they go straight into the exos. If it's a true torus, often I will use a futuro, the Velcro splints, because it's much easier to use, and then I will get them into the hand therapist again and they get an exos fitted. Which, can get wet, can stay on, can be removed for showering, can be used as a reinforcement afterwards for the re-injury.
But if it's a true torus fracture, it should be quite stable, such that a splint would prevent you from hurting it any more than you would have done otherwise. Your concern is, again, that the one that might be masquerading as a torus but is actually a green stick and needs the cast for and the follow-up to ensure there isn't any progression. And at the follow-up with those ones, are you going clinically on deformity? So would you be happy if the arm examined normally, or do you re-x-ray?
Yeah, I'm pretty
those?
Happy if they look straight. So certainly, like, when they come out of their splint, if it looks straight, I'm happy. So I check that it's not tender, and does it look straight? And if it looks straight and the arm won't rock on a table or anything like that, then I don't re-image them at the end of. So usually they're sort of 5 weeks for the green stick fractures.
And it's interesting, just reflecting back to the POCUS talk, ultrasound is used in some instances to identify bony injuries and obviously reduces risk of increased radiation exposure to kids. So again, we'll come back to POCUS in a future podcast, but I certainly found reference of torus fractures being investigated with a point of care scan. We had one other email on this topic, and that was from Mark Baxter, who's a GP in the UK, and he directed me to a study that's going on out of Oxford University by the orthopods there called the FORCE study. And that's an ongoing thing at the moment, but they're looking at torus fractures and whether or not they can be managed in nothing at all other than just a tubigrip bandage. And certainly you see it referenced in the NICE guidelines that splints are considered adequate. And but it may be that this study, when it comes out, then makes a recommendation that only a tubigrip is needed. And I think when you read what Stephen said and what you've been saying, the pain or protection from pain is probably one of the key reasons to put a child in a splint initially or a back slab. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that and what the uptake from parents would be. And I wonder if it's because we use the term fracture, if that makes people expect more than a true sort of little buckle deformity with no angulation, whether or not that's more akin to a sprain or not. I don't know what your thoughts would be on using just a tubigrip.
I find that parents and patients are both not entirely happy with that for fractures, but also they don't necessarily understand the difference between a break and a fracture. So try to explain it using both terms as much as possible. I don't think that I'm going to be in any hurry to just use a tubigrip for these types of fractures, but I guess it's when you change from some kind of immobilization to the tubigrip. But pain is the key anyway, so if it's sore, they should be resting it.
Yeah, I think certainly pain is a big factor in how we manage these. I'll put a link to that FORCE study in the show notes so people can have a little look at it. And thank you to Mark for the email pointing that out, and also to Stephen. It's very helpful when people provide us with their thoughts, because a lot of the things that we do on the bites are good to reflect on and to see what the current kind of community is doing, because some studies might say, hey, what about this? But it's very different when you've got a community doing things differently to change, to update their practice sometimes. And it's good to hear feedback from the people out there doing the job. So thank you for your emails. Another orthopedic one here, the pulled elbow. I think it's a great thing to treat, and I love treating them because it's one of those occasions when the patient returns exactly to normal in front of you. Very often, if you're treating somebody for a fracture or you're treating their sore throat, you're helping them on their journey, but they don't immediately get better. Even if you remove a foreign object from someone's eye, there's still some ongoing pain and discomfort and an injury to recover from. But a pulled elbow is almost magical, particularly if the parents are very worried that the child is badly injured and that it was a family member's fault. And you know, but I think a couple of things. I looked into that because a patient or a family member said, what can we do to avoid this happening? And it does seem that avoiding a traction pull on the arm is the best way. But recurring pulled elbows can, it seems, there was that study I linked to that had an ultrasound showed that the annular ligament had a little tear in it, and this kid was treated in a cast for a little while to allow that to heal, and then it stopped subluxing after that. And the other point from that was that some people are using a point of care ultrasound technique to determine the diagnosis rather than jumping to an X-ray. I guess my other take home was, don't be the person who reduces a pulled elbow that's actually a broken arm. So assuming it's a pulled elbow, you've got to be pretty sure from the history and the story, and you should X-ray if there's any unwitnessed fall or anything like that. And the other thing I wanted to just see what your opinions were, Dave, was the pronation versus supination technique. I personally always do elbow flexion and then supination with radial head pressure, and I find that's almost always worked. There's been a couple of occasions when I've had to do pronation, and I've actually found it's worked by pronating in extension. But a lot of the guides will say you'd pronate in flexion. So there seems to be a few different ways to approach reducing a pulled elbow. So what are your thoughts on all of those?
So personally, I prefer the hyperpronation. And the reason I prefer the hyperpronation technique is I don't have to move the elbow. I follow the protocol that was from the original study by Beck, which is the elbow is held at 90 degrees and hyperpronated while palpating the radial head. That's the original study. I know that Starship actually tend to teach that you can do hyperpronation and extension. The supination flexion technique, as originally described, is the elbow may be extended or flexed to 90 degrees. It is supinated and then flexed fully while palpating the radial head. So the reality is you can supinate, you can pronate, you can do it in extension, you can do it in flexion. I am not perfect, and I probably can't reduce about 1 in 10, 1 in 20 pulled elbows. And so I tend to start with hyperpronation in 90 degrees of flexion, and then I will try a supination flexion technique, and then I will X-ray if neither of those have been effective. And then I will immobilize in a sling if the after X-ray, if it's normal, I attempt the techniques both again, and then I put them in a sling for 24 hours and review them. I've seen lots of other options and things, and I don't think there's anything that's perfect. I'm so glad that you haven't had any failures, but I've certainly remember all the ones that I couldn't reduce.
I wouldn't say I haven't had any failures. The ones that aren't, I guess I'm cautious about making sure that it is a pulled elbow prior to kind of committing to doing to treating it as such. And then there is certainly a number of cases that will get reduced via the radiographer, because the positioning for the lateral elbow X-ray seems to reduce some spontaneously. So I've had a number that the radiographer brings back saying, hey, they're using their arm again now after the X-ray. And that certainly occurs. But I've also found that if you think it's a pulled elbow and it hasn't, and the maneuver, whichever one you use, hasn't worked, then often by the next day they've started to use it anyway. And so a 24-hour review, if they're comfortable, they seem to be using it okay afterwards. But I just find that the flexion, supination, holding the wrist, but pressure at the radial head generally seems to work. And I think there's definitely a component of feeling both at the wrist and at the elbow, and not putting any pressure on it. It's not like a manipulation per se. It's more of it's a relatively gentle technique, and then it just sort of, it goes. It's quite I love it as a thing. I find it very satisfying. But so effectively, whatever works for you, I guess, is probably the best one to use.
It's very much like the shoulder relocation, and that you've got to know a few different techniques, because you can't rely on your favorite one to work always. My end result is, if I feel it flick or click under my thumb, I'm happy regardless of whether they're using it. So I will always just leave those ones if I feel it, because I'm so used to feeling it that it's like, yep, that's back in, don't worry. Yes, they're screaming right now, but it'll be fine in about an hour or half an hour and come back tomorrow if they're not using it. So I don't sling those ones, I just leave them. It's the ones that I don't feel the click. If it doesn't click, then I'm not so sure.
And in terms of recurring episodes, have you ever come across the recurring ones that have required splinting or ultrasounding to identify an annular tear or an annular ligament tear, or is that...
No, well, I've not come across ones that have required anything else other than reduction, and it's probably just because I'm not following them up as much that they're probably going back to the GP. So I haven't come across that yet. It would be very interesting.
I think in the future, if I do receive for me the personal experience or looking back at the notes and the history that someone is getting recurring episodes of pulled elbow despite relatively minor pulls, then I might consider then in the future arranging an ultrasound to look for any annular ligament tears, and then discuss with orthopedics after that, depending on the findings. But it was that was the only thing I could find as a thing that could be related to recurring episodes, because ultimately as you grow, then the elbow matures and it ceases to be a problem.
But yes,
yeah, it's I have come across one case where the pulled elbow was reduced the day before, and then I reviewed the kid the next day who was still in pain, and they had a fracture. So it's that's my biggest fear is doing something manipulating a fracture, or manipulating a pulled elbow, but in a case of a fracture. So I think people have to be cautious around those ones. Any other thoughts on a pulled elbow?
No, the history is always important, but it's not always there.
Yeah, and that's the tricky one, is that if a kid walks around the corner and has been playing with their sibling, and mum sees them holding their arm by their side and in pain when they move it, you think, okay, were they just playing around together and had a pull, or have they been climbing on the furniture and fallen? And it's, unless you've got that history, you can't really take the risk. And I guess that's where, again, something like point of care ultrasound might be helpful if you're wanting to avoid over-imaging kids in the future. But yeah, I like it when it's a child who sat down in the road having a tantrum, and the uncle pulled on their arm, and it's like, that, there you go, that's a pulled elbow.
And also there's the posture. So the child with a pulled elbow will hold that affected arm in extension, whereas supracondylar, they'll want to hold it in flexion.
Yeah, definitely. They tend to sit there, just their arm down, and the other hand will be playing on an iPad or something. They're relatively happy until you move them. They get a bit grumpy. Whereas the supracondylar, they're kind of nursing their arm with the other one, and they definitely don't look as happy or as contented. So yeah, they definitely look different. But so that was the pulled elbow. We won't talk about the intersection syndrome, which was last week's. It was, I thought, an interesting cause of forearm pain, not too dissimilar to de Quervain's. But it has a name, and it's common in rowers. It's managed in a very similar way. But the interesting point I found from one of the studies was that the sports people recommended early surgery for this tenosynovitis to release the kind of the crossover where this inflammation happens, in order to get these elite sports people back to playing sport quicker. Because they found if they didn't have the surgery, they adopted a different technique, which then meant that they were less efficient in their rowing, and that they were off for longer. And so if they just jump in early surgery, get back to rowing and back to normal, whereas all the other advices were you rest this for a long period of time and you go through physio. And it's that difference between sports, managing sports people, and non-sports people, and that's a bit of an issue for us in urgent care, because we get all kinds of people coming through don't we? You'll get your Achilles rupture in a 21-year-old sort of top-grade rugby player, and they'll be much more keen to seek surgery for that, despite, you know, recommendations than the 50-year-old who popped their Achilles just pushing the car. So sports, do you have any thoughts on managing sports people?
It's very challenging, and yes, they are managed usually differently. My management is usually based on how important sport is to them. If it's their life, then they go to a sports physician, and they can get fast tracked for surgery if required, because you can't do these things. It's very hard that when you talk to people in the hospital, they will say that we usually manage this conservatively for pretty much everything. So I think that's where the sports physicians play the big role.
Yeah. Sports people get MRI'd more frequently. They tend to have injections more frequently, don't they? They'll undergo procedures that you might not do in the rest of the population. And there's obviously the considerations about certain medications that you can't give if they're an elite athlete. So they're definitely a little subset of the population that we see. And something like intersection syndrome is relatively easy to manage, I guess, in the normal population. But the tricky ones I find are the ones who are aspiring to be elite. So they're not quite elite yet. So because the really elite ones will often have their own team doctor and sports physicians already. But it's the ones who are aspiring, and there's often parental involvement then as well. And if in doubt, I'd send them off to a sports physician if it's an injury ACC thing. But let's move on to the news. Just a couple of cases I've pulled from the news. The first was a story that I read. It was on the Guardian website, and it was just an interesting cause of a sore throat. This old chap was going back and forth to doctors with a sore throat, and eventually, as he was getting worse and starting to have difficulty swallowing, a soft tissue X-ray of his neck showed that his false teeth was lodged, and that the cause of that was they'd probably been dislodged during surgery. He'd had an anaesthetic earlier, and it had dislodged his false teeth, and that nobody noticed. The anaesthetist didn't notice, and that his false teeth were lodged around his larynx. And so it was an interesting cause of sore throat. So this chap kept coming back with ongoing sore throat, treated as infection and post-operative kind of inflammation. Have you ever come across a false teeth lodged in the throat as a cause of sore throat?
No, strangely enough, it's not something I've actually seen. You're always aware of false teeth when you were intubating in the emergency department, and it was pretty much get them out before as you were looking, and also, you know, track down the false teeth. Where are they? Have we got them? Because if you've got them, then they can't be down there. But no, I've never actually seen it happen.
And I guess my thought process around this is that if somebody keeps coming back with the same symptom, you obviously escalate your investigations accordingly, don't you? You might see them on day one and think, okay, sore throat, looks a bit inflamed, you've got a viral pharyngitis, here's some medicine. But if they keep coming back and keep knocking on the door, and this is one problem I think we have in an urgent care setting, is that we're not privy to all the presentations to other people, and they might have been to other clinics and might have been to their GP, they might have been to ED, and if they don't tell us that information, we might not be privy to how many times they've come back. So it's an important part of our job is to ascertain how many presentations, because frequent presentations should lead to escalated concern and investigation, I guess, from our point of view. Would you agree with that?
Well, yeah, I think with the hoarse voice or the recurrent sore throat, someone should have a look. It's just a matter of when.
Do you ever use any, like, the in a urgent care setting, or in a community setting, there's the old fashioned mirrors that some people use to try and get a look at the around the corner down into the larynx. Have you ever used that kind of indirect mirror technique to look around the corner, or do you just use a tongue depressor, say "ah," and then if they need anything further, they go to ENT?
Yeah, pretty much the latter. I'm just not that good at using the mirrors, and I'm not sure that I've got a mirror in my clinic anymore. I used to do it in the ED quite a bit, have a look and see if we could find fish bones and things, but it was quite challenging with the basic equipment. You have to know how to use it and use it frequently.
Yeah, but certainly, like you say, hoarse voice, and he was an elderly chap, you know, that's says ENT on it, change of voice and ongoing symptoms anyway. But and I guess it goes to some of your comments in the past about other things. Is it a test that is going to satisfactorily exclude what I'm thinking? And if you're not able to, if you have a mirror and you look and unless you're confident that it's normal, then it's really not worth doing unless it's going to actually change the situation. I'm not aware if anyone does use mirrors anymore, but some of the old timers might still have them kicking around. The other story I just wanted to raise, and it relates to what's going on in Auckland at the moment in terms of the measles outbreak there, but this was an Israeli flight attendant on a flight from New York, took ill, diagnosed with measles at the age of 43, and sadly died from measles. They're saying it's the third death from measles in Israel since November. And you see in the Herald this week, the headlines are measles outbreak, and it's certainly the most number of cases the country's had for some time. And this highlights that obviously people can be quite sick from it. And you were saying to me that in Auckland you've had quite a high hospitalization from measles, is that right?
Yes. Yesterday's update it's probably already out of date. They said 585, but I think we're over 600 cases and 40% admission rate. About 6% of the cases are unimmunized or incomplete immunization. So certainly does show that the vast number are the unimmunized cases. And I don't think we're fortunate not to have had any deaths in this country so far, but that it's not over yet. And also you can have delayed encephalitis up to 8 years after measles. So they're not out of the woods yet.
And the reasons for referring measles cases to the hospital, what have been your understanding as the reasons that people are being referred?
So I think a lot of them present to the hospital. I'm not sure how many cases we've had in our clinic. It's probably four or five, but none of them have had to be sent to hospital. And I guess the question is, are they diagnosed with measles and then get unwell and are sent to hospital, or are they diagnosed in hospital as they're so unwell? And we know you can be pretty unwell. And I guess a lot of those people are just going directly to the emergency department. But none of ours have had to be referred in acutely from us. We do a lot of tests that are negative because we're just not sure about the rashes anymore. What a year ago we would say, oh, this is just a viral rash. Now we're considering, gosh, is this measles? I'm not sure that any of them have been typical. Like, none of them have had all the aspects of a classical measles case. And you know, when they say diagnosis is clinical, I'm not sure that it's quite as easy as that. I think we're probably getting a little bit better, that we've seen enough now that we can say, oh, yes, I recognize this rash. In the same way that you recognize, you know, chickenpox and pityriasis versicolor, that if you've seen it a few times, then your memory banks recognize it. It's hard to identify these things from pictures. You know, if you've got a case of secondary syphilis and you've not really seen it before, you're more wondering what this rash is rather than I know what this rash is.
And you linked on the Facebook to a blog post by Justin Morganston at the first 10 EM. He did a little review of measles. It's one of those things that when you don't see it very often, the first case is, it makes you think. But then when there's more and more cases coming around, that familiarity develops. And so you're much more alert and aware of it. And familiarity brings a certain comfort level with seeing and diagnosing. But if it's been, if you've never seen it in practice, the first one is obviously the one that causes you the most concern. I'll put a link to Justin's blog on that. And interestingly, just today, again, in The Guardian, there's a thing on polio. They're saying that Nigeria marks its third year without wild polio case, and they're predicting that Africa can be declared free of the disease in 2020. So on one hand, polio seems to be finally being pushed out of Africa, but we've got measles still ongoing. So the whole immunization thing rolls on. Now, if we go to college news, the urgent care boot camp is in 3 weeks now, and you're doing a talk there. You're doing a presentation.
Yes, I haven't actually finished writing it yet, so it's still only in my brain. But it is something that I've had to do in the past on a much larger scale. So basically, what I have to do is trim it back to 10 minutes, which is, I don't think I've ever talked for 10 minutes on a topic in my life. It's usually an hour plus. So it'll be difficult to be concise, but I will do my best.
I've been assigned two slots that are 5 minutes long. So I've like you, I've got it all written in my head, but it's choosing what's relevant and what to leave out is the difficult thing at the moment, to try and get it down to that 5 minutes. Because that's the idea, is that it's multiple presentations that are fast and bite-sized to enhance learning. So information's on the website. There's the full list of presentations. There will be a podcast representation there, and we'll talk about that nearer the time with Afraz, who's going to talk to us about it hopefully next week. But the boot camp's coming up. The skills, the S-door, anything to say on that, Dave, for those?
This is one of the biggest things that the college does. It's quite a lot of work, and it's been pretty intense here in the office. We're only just getting in control of all the equipment and things, so it'll be something to really look forward to this weekend, and I look forward to meeting any of you who are coming up for it or down for it or around the corner. It's going to have radiology this year, which is a challenge, but I'm sure it'll go well. In the end, I'm sitting in the office here with three big widescreen viewers that we're organising for our radiology to go on. It's not completely working yet, but there's still 2 days to go, so I'm sure it'll work in the end. It's going to be great.
So that's this weekend coming, but it'll be last weekend when people hear this, because we're recording it a little bit in advance. But
I'm sure everything went well then.
Everything went really well, and as long as everybody knows that a lot of effort was put in, and it's hopefully they can come up and say thank you when they come to the boot camp for all that hard work. The only other college news, which was new since our last talk, was that the college Twitter account is now running at RNZCUC. So if you're on Twitter, you can follow us there and posting blogs and podcasts, links and the like. And as I referenced in one of the bites on the shark fin sign, you can find some gems of educational like papers and cases and stories there. You have to wade through some nonsense as well, but it's quite a good source of up-to-date information for people, if you choose the people you follow wisely. But yeah, if you do, if you're on Twitter, then please follow the college. And yeah, we'll wrap that up. Dave, let you carry on with the S-Door and writing your bootcamp presentation. And thank you again for being the co-host on this and going through and giving us your thoughts on what we've been doing in the last couple of months. And we'll catch up over the bootcamp weekend on the 14th of September. So we'll see you then.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks for listening. The information discussed in this podcast was intended for the ongoing professional development of qualified health professionals and should not be used for self-diagnosis. For any personal medical concerns, please consult your usual doctor.